My friends, no story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself.
We stand on the shoulders of more cinematic giants in this, the 11th episode of the History of Film, Titans of French Film Part 2, Léon Gaumont and Alice Guy. Hello all and welcome back to the History of Film. This episode is a little bit late, thank you for your patience, but we are now back on track and on with the show. In the last episodes, I described the film empire of Charles Pathé, a name still familiar to moviegoers around the world to this day. I covered the Pathé Company's multinational reach, its work in the propagation and dissemination of film technologies and genre, and its first star, Max Linder. But while Pathé was the biggest game in town, that town being, well, Europe, but mostly France, Pathé was not the only game in town. This week, we cover the development of Gaumont Productions, Pathé's only major competitor. We'll also talk about Gaumont's first and most important early director, Alice Guy, who was also the first female filmmaker. This is important information in and of itself, but it's also contextually necessary for the continuing history of film, as in future episodes, we will be coming back to France to study the early crime thrillers produced by Gaumont, including The Phantoms and The Vampires, which are also the origins of serial cinema. Léon Gaumont was born in Paris, France, on the 10th of May, 1864. In the book Who's Who of Victorian Cinema, Gaumont is described as, quote, modestly born but mechanically minded. Putting aside the somewhat strange wording of that description, I went hunting for what modest circumstances Gaumont was born into and couldn't find much. Biographies of Gaumont are devilishly hard to find in English, and even in French, details from reliable sources are locked in dusty tomes and behind academic paywalls. The best information I could get was from his French language Wikipedia entry, which states, quote, that his mother was a chambermaid and his father was a coachman. So take that for what it's worth. Most of Gaumont's early life is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, as Winston Churchill famously phrased, though of course not in reference to Léon Gaumont. So, of necessity, we will be skipping our customary overview of Gaumont's early childhood, and instead begin straight away with Gaumont's professional life, which I actually can find at least some things out about. Léon Gaumont put his quote-unquote mechanical mind to work, and as a 17-year-old had a notebook with concept designs for successive photo projection. It was also at 17 years old that Gaumont went to work for the precision mechanics manufacturer Jules Carpentier in 1881, which is only worth noting because Carpentier would end up manufacturing the cinematograph for the Lumière brothers a decade and a half later. If one believed in fate, it would be easy to think that Gaumont's fate was tied to the motion picture. In 1888, the young Léon would marry Camille Millard, a young woman of means, and her dowry would buy the land that would eventually become Gaumont Studios. In 1893, Gaumont began his employment at the company of Félix and Jules Ricard, called the Comptoir Général des Photographies, and was offered the opportunity to buy the company in 1895, which he accepted. Gaumont renamed the company after himself and entered into a business partnership with some of the most influential men in Paris, including Gustave Eiffel, who designed the tower that bears his name. So, in a murky way that I don't completely understand, Léon Gaumont went from being a poor child of modest means to owning a company specializing in optics backed by people whose names are still recognizable in 2021, all before the age of 35. The newly christened Gaumont Company was one of many that was competing to develop the motion picture. As you may remember from earlier episodes, the various components that made up movies, namely sequence photography and magic lantern projectors, were well known by 1895. For many inventors, it was only a matter of who would cross the finish line first and make a motion picture device that could be marketed to the public. Gaumont entered the ring with a device whose patent was owned by one Georges Demenet. Demenet was a former collaborator of our old Episode 1 friend, Antoine Jules Marais, who invented the chronophotographic gun, which would later go on to being the piece of technology that Thomas Edison and W.K.L. Dixon would use to bring their own kinetograph device to life. Unfortunately for Gaumont, Demenet's phonoscope camera was difficult and cumbersome, using a combination of glass discs to record and unperforated film to project, meaning that sprockets could not be used to keep film in place and moving at a uniform speed. This, of course, would not do, and did not do. The phonoscope failed, even after being renamed Biograph. That, by the way, was supposed to be a little bit of a joke, as it seems like there were a million systems and companies named Biograph in early film. This one, while called Biograph, is not the same as the other Biograph that we'll be covering in future episodes. Perhaps the most important reason the Gaumont system failed was its unfortunate proximity of debut to the much more famous and well-received cinematograph of the Lumière brothers. The first cinematograph tickets were sold just over a month after Gaumont's system released. The Gaumont Company, in response to their own failure and the overwhelming success of the Lumière brothers, would go back to the drawing board, creating a much more usable camera. It recorded on perforated film, thank goodness, and by 1897 would use 35mm film, which is still an industrial standard to this day. We will cover the adoption of the 35mm film standard as a housekeeping topic in episode 12, as it hasn't fit super well into any of our episodes so far. Gaumont's new camera found a market, and the Gaumont Company began to prosper, albeit in the menacing shadow of the Pathé Company. Léon Gaumont himself was not an artist. It would seem that the reason the Gaumont Company entered the motion picture market was not to make money by producing and distributing movies, but from manufacturing and selling movie cameras. As such, Gaumont himself has no reputation for great or even paltry artistic achievements, but instead advances in film marketing and technological developments. No, the now middle-aged and economically successful Gaumont would leave the production of his company's movies to people who were interested in actually making them. And when they made them, they, at first, made them not for public exhibition, but as demonstration films, to entice potential buyers of the camera by showing just how fantastic it was. Enter Gaumont's young secretary, Alice Guy. A clarifying note before we begin the remarkable life and work of Alice Guy. If any of you have heard of her, you may have heard of her by her married name, Alice Guy Blaché. In this show, I usually refer to people by their last name. I will be referring to Alice Guy as Guy and not Blaché for a couple of reasons. Number one, she made a lot of her movies before she was married, and I don't think it's exactly accurate to refer to her as Blaché before then. And secondly, her husband was also a filmmaker, though a much less important one. And if he comes up in future episodes, or even later in this episode, it could become tedious and confusing for you to parse out which one of them I'm talking about. Hence, for our purposes, her name will remain the same throughout her whole career, Alice Guy. Alice Guy was born in France on the 1st of July, 1873. After her infancy in France, Guy spent her early childhood in the nation of Chile, where her father owned a bookstore and a publishing business. At the age of 6, Guy would be sent to Switzerland to attend school at a convent with her sisters, before returning to France, this time with the whole family. Guy's early life was marred by a certain amount of personal tragedy. Both her father and older brother died unexpectedly when she was relatively young. After her sisters married or left the household, Guy and her mother were left, more or less, to themselves, with the young Alice being the source of income for the two of them. As you may imagine, jobs for women of the bourgeoisie were very limited in late 19th century Paris. At the advice of a family friend, Guy studied secretarial science, as secretary work was one of the most highly favored employment opportunities for young women of the time. Guy eventually landed an interview with Léon Gaumont at the Comptoir Général de Photographie. In characteristic whimsical humor, Guy recalled that Gaumont noted her age, 22, and said that she was very young for such an important position. Guy replied, "Sir, it will pass." Impressed, Gaumont hired her as a secretary for what would soon be the Gaumont Company. As you already know, the Lumière brothers extended special invitations to inventors, businessmen, and showmen to see advanced screenings of their cinematograph. Gaumont and Guy attended one of these, and Guy would find the experience wonderful. Once the Gaumont Company made a commercially viable moving picture system, Guy asked if she would be permitted to make some of the demonstration films. According to Guy's recollections, Gaumont's response was, It seems like a silly, girlish thing to do, but you can try if you want, on one condition, that your office work does not suffer. I want to pause here for a moment and further discuss what I just said, because I think it's one of the most important parts of understanding how and why women were socially allowed to participate in early film. And women were socially allowed to participate in early film. Women did most of the editing and colorizing work for movies, which was seen as deeply unglamorous, and many early films were written and even directed by women. Sexism still deeply hurts society in every imaginable facet in the year 2021, but in the late 19th century, women were essentially forbidden from having any prestige work, except being Queen of England. And as Léon Gaumont just so helpfully expressed, women thrived in movies before the age of Hollywood precisely because it was viewed as silly and unimportant. Cinema was a low-class activity for the uncouth masses, not even requiring literacy to be enjoyed, and lacking the sophistication of the theater. But cinema was perfect for women who weren't able to work most of the real jobs anyway. Because Gaumont saw the real man's work of his industry to be making and selling cameras and projectors, Guy was allowed to do the unglamorous work of actually making the movies. This, of course, would change. As we will cover in many, many episodes from now, as movies became more prestigious and lucrative, the social structures that perpetuate the existing systems of power largely, though never fully, removed women from the filmmaking process starting in the 1920s. But until then, Guy is one of many women editing, coloring, and even directing films. And she's going to start right now. In 1896, Guy made her movie, The Cabbage Patch Fairy, which only recently entered history books as one of the most important early films. It's a simple movie in which a fairy, a woman, in a cabbage patch pulls out newborn babies from the cabbages, showing in a sweet and funny way where babies come from. I have read and heard this movie described variously as one of the first narrative films, or one of the first films with a plot. I myself wouldn't describe The Cabbage Patch Fairy that way. Now, to be fair, I'm sure that the people who wrote these things are using different definitions of narrative and plot than most of us use, and these people definitely are bona fide film scholars, and I am not. Their credentials are much better than mine. But in making a movie that can effectively be described as a woman pulls babies from a cabbage patch, I actually think Alice Guy did something more important than making one of the first narrative films. If you recall the Lumiere film The Waterer Watered, you'll remember that narrative film existed immediately, at the same time short actualités like A Train Arrives at the Station did. And believe it or not, that is one of the most important things about The Waterer Watered. The first films containing artificially constructed narratives, or sequences of events with cause and effect written and directed for the purpose of making a movie, were shown without meaningful distinction alongside pieces of short documentary film. Imagine seeing movies for the first time in 1895, in a theater showing a sequence of short actualités or performance recordings. One could, conceivably, see a movie like The Waterer Watered in that environment, not as a constructed narrative, but as a prank that was recorded in the moment. But when you see Alice Guy's movie The Cabbage Patch Fairy, there is no question that what you are watching is constructed. Guy's film was decidedly not real. Georges Méliès' first of such movies, The Vanishing Woman, was released that same year, maybe a little bit later than Alice Guy's movie. Even with her earliest films, Guy already demonstrated a few key traits that I think define her career and impact. Number one, Alice Guy is always quick to use advanced cinematic technology and technique. Looking for the person who actually first used a technique is fun, and I've done some of it on this show, but it isn't always very helpful. Even when Guy is not technically the first person to use something like, let's say, double exposure, she is always among the earliest adopters, and uses the technique with remarkable fluency. Two, Guy's content is always creative and of truly superior quality. While all of the early great directors had their skills, and some were better than Guy in different areas of filmmaking, as you would expect from anyone, there are very few who can compete with the quality of what Guy actually puts on screen. And finally, three, Guy's movies, perhaps by virtue of her experience, focus more on women than the movies of most other early filmmakers, who were men. Please do not misunderstand my earlier comment. Though there were many women filmmakers in early cinema, the vast majority of people making movies were men, and they made content about men. Guy's movies often, though not always, put women at the forefront of their subjects, which is as remarkable in the late 19th century as it is enjoyable for the 2021 viewer. Now, I bet all of you would like to hear more about Alice Guy's films. Well, while I would love to tell you all about them right now, I'm afraid you'll have to wait just a little bit. At this moment in our story, Alice Guy has just made her first movie at the age of 23 or 24, and has two more decades of making movies in front of her across two different continents with burgeoning film technologies. It would be a bit unwieldy to put 20 to 30 minutes of description and historical analysis in the middle of an episode that is already a little late and is ballooning to an incredible length. To resolve this problem, make sure to tune in next week to episode 11A, where we'll go over some of Alice Guy's movies in greater detail, in much the same way that we've done for the Lumiere brothers and Thomas Edison in the past. I don't think it should have its own numbered episode, because the content really belongs here, in the middle of episode 11. Of necessity, we will continue to describe some of Alice Guy's movies today, but expect more and more in-depth looks at them next week. With Guy's movie, The Cabbage Patch Fairy, Guy had proven her ability to make unique films that would demonstrate the true power of the Gaumont camera. I imagine when Gaumont saw Guy's film, he sounded just like this, a historical reenactment of the moment from the movie Star Wars: Revenge of the Sith. Armed with Guy's newfound, unlimited power, Gaumont would sell his cameras like hotcakes. Guy's position would change from Gaumont's secretary to his head of production, in charge of Gaumont's entire filmmaking operation. So Guy wasn't just the first female director, she wasn't just one of the first directors, period, she was also one of the very first heads of production in all of film. Gaumont's equipment soon took second place in the French market, behind the industrial juggernaut that was Pathé Films. Gaumont's ambitions were high, and Gaumont-produced film began to be distributed to the public. In those early, lawless, Wild West days of French cinema, plagiarism and theft of film was rampant, and it was possible for filmmakers to acquire a copy of someone else's movie and pass it off as their own work, as Thomas Edison did with the Georges Méliès movie A Trip to the Moon. As such, French producers chose symbols that would be present in their movies to designate who actually made and owned them. For Pathé, it was the famous rooster. Georges Méliès chose a star, and Gaumont chose a daisy. On the daisy were written the letters E-L-G-E, the phonetic spelling of Léon Gaumont's initials, L-G. Alice Guy was responsible for making many, many films with daisies in them. As head of production and director, her output was enormous. The early French studios had incredible rivalries, and in attempts to one-up each other, the Gaumont and Pathé studios would copy each other's films. You can see an interesting kind of dueling movie phenomena develop. For example, Guy made the movie The Race for the Sausage in 1907, in which a dog grabs some sausage from a butcher, and an increasingly large number of townsfolk chase after it. The film ends with a close-up of the dog with his precious sausage. Now, the Pathé-produced 1907 film The Policeman's Little Run, directed by Ferdinand Zecca, is about a dog who grabs some meat on the bone from a butcher, and an increasingly large number of police officers chase after it. The closing shot of the film is a close-up of the dog, with his precious meat on the bone, wearing a policeman's cap. According to the 2018 film Be Natural, The Untold Story of Alice Guy, directed by Pamela B. Green, Guy was the one who made the original film, and Pathé the copy. This surprised me, as the Pathé film The Policeman's Little Run has been one of my favorite early movies since I first saw it on the laser disc of Landmarks of Early Cinema years ago. I never knew until doing the research for this episode that that movie was essentially a copy, although I will say it does still have merit on its own terms. But, lest you feel too much righteous anger, Gaumont copied Pathé as well, and as Gaumont's head of production, so did Guy. In 1906, Gaumont produced the Alice Guy directed The Birth, the Life, and the Death of Christ, a movie made as a direct response to the Pathé produced and Zecca directed The Life and Passion of Christ of 1903. There are, of course, technical differences between the two films. For one, Zecca's film is about 15 minutes longer. But, in classic Alice Guy fashion, what really stands out is the content of her movie. In Guy's Christ story, the life of Jesus Christ after his birth and before his trial and crucifixion is told in just three Bible stories, all three of which were specifically about women. During the trial and crucifixion scenes, Guy's truly massive crowds, by 1906 standards, were mostly women and children. Zecca's film was a breathtakingly long, still excellent movie, using the Bible as its subject matter. Guy's film is shorter, but still tremendous, especially in her use of crowds, stage direction, and composition, that makes a statement about how Christ's life can sometimes be viewed by people who lack systemic power, namely women and children. As film production continued to grow at the Gaumont Company, Guy hired people to help her with the large amounts of work she needed to do. Among those who Guy hired were Victorin Hippolyte Jasset and Louis Fouldier, both of which became important directors in their own right. Unfortunately, many of Guy's accomplishments would later be misattributed to them. Other Gaumont employees hired by Guy, according to the book A Short History of Film, include Henri Menessier and, shockingly, Ferdinand Zecca. Léon Gaumont would soon become involved with pursuing his company's entrance into its next inevitable technological step, sound film. We've already seen Thomas Edison and W.K.L. Dixon make an experimental sound film as early as 1894 or 1895. When Dixon did it, he had his musicians and actors perform in front of a giant cone to funnel the sound that the subjects of the film were creating into a phonograph. If you'll remember, it sounded like this. That sounds a little clumsy and difficult, even just listening to it. The video is even more so, I promise. Compare that to this excellent example of Gaumont's Chronophone, released in 1902 to 1904. This particular example is from an Alice Guy recording from 1905 called 5 O'Clock Tea Time. Very different, and the video is equally more polished. What made that difference is very simple. Edison and Dixon recorded their sound live, while the Gaumont system had actors lip-sync and dance to a record that would be played in time with the movie. While not the harbinger of the new era of sound film that Gaumont clearly dreamed it would be, the Chronophone was still a success. The impracticalities of analog sound recording and reproduction would make silent movies the standard motion picture format for almost two more decades, but at its most technologically impressive, the Chronophone was audible to an audience of over 4,000 eager cinema-goers. Alice Guy, of course, was placed in charge of making the first demonstration movies with the Chronophone system. Here's a snippet of one of her films, entitled The Trottin's Polka from 1905.
Le matin, quand de pied mutin, avec votre bagage, vous courez à l'ouvrage. Des flatteurs amateurs de votre candeur vous font du badinage d'un petit air séducteur.
Unfortunately for the viewer, the Chronophone film lacks much of the early creativity of subject and technical mastery that would make movies fun to watch. And as you would expect, even Alice Guy relied on the sheer amazing novelty of a singing, talking moving picture to showcase the technology. Which was the point of the movies she was making. Believing wholeheartedly in the future of the Chronophone, Gaumont made Guy a missionary of sorts for the device, and sent her across Europe to preach its wonders. And that is when Alice Guy became engaged to Herbert Blaché, Herbert Blaché Bolton was a British-born Gaumont employee who worked with Guy in France as a cameraman before going to Germany to manage the Gaumont operation there. Guy was sent by Gaumont to Germany to assist his clients with the use of the chronophone system. While in Germany, Guy and Blaché became a couple and were engaged soon after, and were married in 1907. At this point, Alice Guy gained her now more commonly used name, Alice Guy Blaché. Obviously, this episode is about Alice Guy, and to a lesser extent, Léon Gaumont. While Herbert Blaché continues to make movies well into the golden age of silent film in Hollywood, his overall impact is less than his wife's, and we won't talk about him much here. But just know, until their divorce, he was sort of kicking around in the background between all the times he's mentioned in relation to our story. Early 20th century politics and employment practices being what they were, as a married woman, Alice Guy was no longer permitted to work for the Gaumont Company. Her husband, however, was, and was sent to the United States to promote the chronophone. Guy recommended the now famous director Louis Fouillade as her replacement. And we will be talking more about him in future episodes as we return to France and the Gaumont Company down the line. After moving to the United States and taking about 2 years to settle and have a child, Guy started making movies again. She opened her own motion picture studio called Solax Films in Fort Lee, New Jersey. Fort Lee was the first motion picture capital of the United States before it was left behind for the greener pastures of Hollywood, California at the end of the 1910s. We'll be going into greater detail within the next few episodes, so consider this show a preview of the coming attraction of Fort Lee in future weeks. Guy's Solax studio was a massive building with large windows that would let in copious amounts of sunlight that was needed to record motion pictures with early movie cameras. While not as dramatically gargantuan as the behemoth studios that would grow up in Hollywood, Solax was state-of-the-art and spacious for its day, containing all of the requisite materials to make movies from start to finish, including sets, offices, editing rooms, film production labs, and costuming. In her studio, Guy hung a massive sign that read, "Be Natural," a reminder to her actors that naturalistic acting was their primary objective. This was achieved in her Solax movies with mixed results, with some actors providing remarkable performances, and others continuing to use the comically exaggerated actions common to silent films of the era. You can actually see some of her actors who are better and worse at the same time at, quote, being natural, together in the same movie, on screen, at the same moment. We'll talk about it next week. Solax became one of the major film studios during the Fort Lee era of American filmmaking, and at its head, there was Guy, the world's first female director, who was also the world's first female studio head. During her time at Solax, Guy made extremely interesting films, including the first American film with an all-black cast, which we will talk about next week. Unfortunately here, as we so often see when combing through the earliest history of film, a series of life difficulties would strike Alice Guy and end her career as a filmmaker, just as with Georges Méliès before her. At the end of the 1910s, film companies began to migrate en masse to California, and Solax began facing economic hardship. Guy began to rent Solax studio space to other production companies, including MGM Pictures and David O. Selznick Productions. At the same time, Herbert Blaché's infidelities led to the couple's separation. Alice stayed on the East Coast with her now two children, while Herbert Blaché moved to Hollywood, eventually working for Universal Pictures. After 1917, Alice made a few more movies, moving across the country to Hollywood briefly, but Solax and personal debt from some of Herbert's finance decisions left both Alice and her studio with no money to speak of. Guy's last movie, titled Tarnished Reputations, was released in 1920. Solax went bankrupt, one building burning down, and the other company property being sold at auction. Guy and her children moved to France, where she would never make another movie. Alice Guy lived a long time, dying at age 94 in 1968. That means she lived from 1873, saw and made some of the very first movies, and died just a few years before Bonnie and Clyde was released in 1967. Her life encompassed more than the first 70 years of film. As the study of film history developed, to her shock and dismay, she found that in developing histories of film, her work was almost always attributed to other people. usually people she had hired to work for her. Her films were often attributed to her ex-husband, Herbert Blaché, as well. Through ignorance, misinformation, or sheer sexism, Alesky was largely written out of many early film histories. Virtually all of her movies were lost, with less than a handful known to survive during her lifetime. The woman who helped create, transform, and propagate cinema across the world, now forgotten, would spend her later years trying to correct the record she was excluded from. During this process, she wrote her memoirs, published after her death, and wrote letters and gave interviews that have proven to be extremely valuable for film historians today. She would eventually receive the Legion of Honor in 1953 for her achievements in cinema. At the very end of her life, she returned to the United States with her daughter before passing away once again in New Jersey. Before her death, she wrote about her life, saying, "Is it a failure? Is it a success? I don't know." Of the over 1,000 movies she directed, she had only found two and a fragment of a third before she died. Apparently, as far as film history was concerned, the world didn't know either. Our story, of course, does not end there. It was in the second half of the 20th century that feminist film historians and archivists discovered, you might say, the films of Alesky as they were searching for records and films of women in the early days of cinema. As you can imagine, her career was an astonishing revelation. In an industry still dominated by men in 2021, finding that one of the earliest directors and a powerful American studio head was a woman changed the way that people had to think about the role of women in early film. This caused a beautiful chain reaction. As more and more people learned about Guy, more and more archivists searched their archives for her movies. As more of her movies were found, more people learned of her place in film history. In the year 2021, about 150 of Guy's movies are known to have survived, a remarkable improvement over 2.5. While Alesky isn't quite what I would say remembered in the sense that Georges Méliès is remembered, many film historians and scholars are working to make sure that her place in cinema's history is recognized. Her achievements are increasingly highlighted in film history books, and even the short YouTube series Crash Course Film History, though it admittedly is a footnote in their episode about Georges Méliès. In 2018, a high-prestige, high-production-value documentary called Be Natural, The Untold Story of Alesky was released to high acclaim, and you should watch it. It goes into much greater depth than I do here about her life, and was a very helpful resource in writing this episode. And for any of you listening who hadn't heard of her until now, hopefully her place in cinema's history is now important to you. We all create history by our perspectives on it. And as our collective understandings of the origins of film continue to complexify, we can choose to make it more accurate and inclusive, and continue to ensure that this titan of French and early American film is not forgotten again. Thank you for listening to the 11th episode of The History of Film. I really do appreciate your patience, as this episode has taken quite a long time to produce. I also have a quick correction from the last episode. Max Linder, as it turns out, isn't quite as forgotten as I said. And his name does appear in not just one, but several of my film history books. I simply missed his name by not doing careful enough research using those particular books. I am absolutely thrilled to be wrong about this, and I hope that in the future more movies and filmmakers that I think are forgotten turn out to be more remembered than I expected. If you like the show and want to help it grow, the best ways you can do that are to tell your friends about it and to leave a review wherever you listen. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com and visit the show's website to see some of the movies that we talk about in every episode at historyoffilmpodcast.com. I'm going to have part 2 of this episode, 11A, out next week, so you shouldn't have such a long wait this time. Join me then for another exciting episode of The History of Film.